The Freudian thing, or the meaning of the return to Freud in psychoanalysis. An expanded version of a lecture given at the Vienna Neuropsychiatric Clinic of November 7th, 1955. Situation in time and place of this exercise. At a time when Vienna, in making itself heard again through the voice of its opera, is reassuming, in a moving variation, its old age mission at a crossroads of cultures from which she was able to create harmony, I have come here, not unfittingly, I think, to evoke the fact that this chosen city will remain, this time forevermore, associated with a revolution in knowledge of Copernican proportions. I'm referring to the fact that Vienna is the eternal site of Freud's discovery, and that, owing to this discovery, the veritable center of human beings is no longer at the place ascribed to it by an entire humanist tradition. Perhaps even prophets, whose own countries were not entirely deaf to them, must be eclipsed at some point in time, if only after their death. It is appropriate for a foreigner to exercise restraint in evaluating the forces at work in such a phase effect. The return to Freud, for which I am assuming here the role of herald, is thus situated elsewhere, where it is amply called for by the symbolic scandal which Dr. Alfred Winterstein, who is here with us today, rightly highlighted when it occurred during his tenure as president of the Vienna Psychoanalytic Society, namely, upon the inauguration of the commemorative plaque marking the house in which Freud pursued his heroic work, the scandal being not that this monument was not dedicated to Freud by his fellow citizens, but that it was not commissioned by the International Association of Those Who Live Off His Patronage. This failure is symptomatic, for it indicates that he was disowned, not by the land in which, by virtue of his tradition, he was merely a temporary guest, but by the very field he left in our care, and by those to whom custody of that field was entrusted, that is, the psychoanalytic movement itself, where things have come to such a pass that to call for a return to Freud is seen as a reversal. Since the time when the first sound of the Freudian message rang out from the Viennese bell to echo far and wide, many contingent factors have played a part in this story. Its reverberations seem to be drowned out by the muffled collapses brought about by the First World Conflict. Its propagation resumed with the immense human wrenching that fomented the Second and was its most powerful vehicle. It was on the waves of hate's tocsin and discord tumult, the panic-stricken breath of war, that Freud's voice reached us, as we witnessed the diaspora of those who transmitted it, whose persecution was no coincidence. The shock waves were to reverberate to the very confines of our world, echoing on a continent where it would be untrue to say that history loses its meaning, since it is where history finds its limit. It would even be a mistake to think that history is absent there, since, already several centuries in duration, it weighs all the more heavily there due to the gulf traced out by its all too limited horizon. Rather, it is where history is denied with a categorical will that gives enterprises their style, that of a cultural ahistoricism characteristic of the United States of North America. This ahistoricism defines the assimilation required for one to be recognized there in the society constituted by this culture. It was to its summons that a group of emigrants had to respond in order to gain recognition. They could only stress their difference, but their function presupposed history at its very core, their discipline being the one that had reconstructed the bridge between modern man and ancient myths. The combination of circumstances was too strong and the opportunity too attractive for them not to give in to the temptation to abandon the core in order to base function on difference. Let us be clear about the nature of this temptation. It was neither that of ease nor that of profit. It is certainly easier to efface the principles of a doctrine than the stigmata of one's origins, and more profitable to subordinate one's function to demand, but to reduce one's function to one's difference, in this case, is to give in to a mirage that is internal to the function itself, a mirage that grounds the function in this difference. It is to return to the reactionary principle that covers over the duality of he who suffers and he who heals with the opposition between he who knows and he who does not. How could they avoid regarding this opposition as true when it is real, and on that basis avoid slipping into becoming managers of souls in a social context that demands such offices? The most corrupting of comforts is intellectual comfort, just as the worst corruption is corruption of the best. Thus Freud's comment to Jung, I have it from Jung's own mouth, when having been invited by Clark University, they arrived in view of New York Harbor and of the famous statue illuminating the universe. They don't realize we're bringing them the plague, was turned against him as punishment for the hubris, whose antiphrasis and darkness do not extinguish its turbid brilliance. To catch its author in her trap, Nemesis had merely to take him at his word. We would be justified in fearing that Nemesis added a first-class ticket home. Indeed, if something of the sort has happened, we have only ourselves to blame, for Europe seems rather to have faded from the concerns and style, if not the minds, of those who left, along with the repression of their bad memories. I will not pity you for having been forgotten, since it leaves me freer to present to you the project of a return to Freud, as some of us teaching at the Société Française de Psychoanalyse conceive of it. We are not seeking to emphasize a return of the repressed here, but want to use the antithesis constituted by the phase that has passed in the psychoanalytic movement since Freud's death to show what psychoanalysis is not, and find with you a way to put back into force what has continued to sustain it, even in its very deviation, namely the original meaning Freud preserved in it by his mere presence, which I should like to explain here. How could this meaning escape us when it is attested to in a body of written work of the most lucid and organic kind? And how could it leave us hesitant when the study of this work shows us that its different stages and changes in direction are governed by Freud's inflexibly effective concern to maintain its original rigor? His texts prove to be comparable to those that, in other times, human veneration has invested with the highest qualities, in that they withstand the test of the discipline of commentary, whose virtue only rediscovers in making use of it in the traditional way, not simply to situate what someone says in the context of his time, but to gauge whether the answer he gives to the questions he raises has or has not been superseded by the answer one finds in his work to current questions. Will I be telling you anything new if I say that these texts, to which for the past 4 years I have devoted a 2-hour seminar every Wednesday from November to July, without having taken up more than a quarter of them, although my commentary is based on the whole set of them, have surprised me, and those who attend my seminars, as only genuine discoveries can. These discoveries range from concepts that have remained unexploited to clinical details left to be unearthed by our exploration. They demonstrate how far the field investigated by Freud went beyond the avenues he left us by which to gain access to it, and how little his case studies, which sometimes give an impression of exhaustiveness, were subordinated to what he intended to demonstrate, who, among the experts in disciplines other than psychoanalysis, whom I have guided in reading these texts, has not been moved by this research in action, whether it is the research he has us follow in Traumdeutung, the interpretation of dreams, the case study of the Wolfman, or Beyond the Pleasure Principle. What an exercise for the training of minds, and what a message to lend one's voice to. And what better confirmation could there be of the methodological value of methodical value of this training and the truth effect this message produces than the fact that the students to whom you transmit them bring you evidence of transformation occurring sometimes overnight in their practice, which becomes simpler or more effective even before it becomes more transparent to them. I cannot provide you with a detailed account of this work in my talk here, for which I am indebted to the kindness of Professor Hoff for the opportunity to give it in this place of noble memory, to the convergence between my views and those of Dr. Arnold for the suggestion to give this talk here, and to my excellent and long-standing relations with Mr. Igor Caruso for knowing how it would be received in Vienna. But I cannot forget that I owe part of my audience today to the indulgence of Mr. Susini, the director of the French Institute in Vienna, and this is why I must ask myself, coming now as I am to the meaning of the return to Freud that I am professing here, whether I am not running the risk of disappointing this part of my audience because it is less prepared than the specialists may be to understand me. The adversary. I'm sure of my answer here. Absolutely not. Assuming that what I am going to say is as it should be. The meaning of a return to Freud is a return to Freud's meaning. And the meaning of what Freud said may be conveyed to anyone because, well, addressed to everyone, it concerns each person. One word suffices to make this point. Freud's discovery calls truth into question, and there is no one who is not personally concerned by truth. It must seem rather odd that I should be flinging this word in your faces, a word of almost ill repute, a word banished from polite society, but isn't it inscribed in the very heart of analytic practice, since this practice is constantly rediscovering the power of truth in ourselves and in our very flesh? Why indeed would the unconscious be more worthy of being recognized than the defenses that oppose it in the subject, so successfully that the defenses seem no less real than it? I am not reviving here the shoddy Nietzschean notion of the lie of life, nor am I marveling at the fact that one believes, nor do I accept that to will something one need but want it badly enough. But I am asking where the peace that ensues the peace that ensues in recognizing an unconscious tendency comes from if the latter is not truer than what restrained it in the conflict. For some time now, this peace has, moreover, been quickly proving illusory. For psychoanalysts, not content to recognize as unconscious the defenses to be attributed to the ego, have increasingly identified the defense mechanisms, displacement of the object, turning back against the subject, regression of form, with the very dynamic that Freud analyzed in the tendency, which thus seems to persist in the defenses with no more than a change of sign. Haven't people gone too far when they submit that the drive itself may be made conscious by the defense so that the subject won't recognize himself in it? In order to try to explain these mysteries in a coherent discourse, I am, in spite of myself, using words that reestablish in that discourse the very duality that sustains them. But what I deplore is not that one cannot see the forest of the theory for the trees of the technique employed, but rather that it would take so little to believe that one is in the Bondi forest, precisely because of the following notion, which is hiding behind each tree, namely, that there must be some trees that are truer than others, or, if you prefer, that not all trees are bandits, without which one might wind up asking where the bandits are who are not the trees. Does this little, then, which can become everything on occasion, perhaps deserve an explanation? What is this truth without which there is no way of distinguishing the face from the mask, and apart from which there seems to be no other monster than the labyrinth itself. In other words, how are they to be distinguished in truth if they are all equally real? Here the big clodhoppers come forward to slip onto the dove's feet, on which, as we know, truth is born, and to swallow up the bird occasionally as well, a criterion, they cry, is simply economic, you ideologists. Not all organizations of reality are equally economical. But at the point at which truth has already been brought to bear, the bird escapes unscathed when I ask, economical for whom? Things have gone too far this time, the adversary snickers. We get the picture. Monsieur has a philosophical bent. Plato and Hegel will be showing up any minute now. Their stamp suffices. Whatever they endorse should be discarded. And anyway, if, as you said, this concerns everyone, it's of no interest to specialists like us. It can't even be classified in our documentation. You think I'm joking here, but not at all. I subscribe to it. If Freud contributed nothing more to the knowledge of man than the verity that there is something veritable, there is no Freudian discovery. Freud simply belongs, then, to the line of moralists in whom a tradition of humanistic analysis is embodied, a Milky Way in the heavenly vault of European culture, in which Balthazar Gracian and La Rochefoucauld are among the brightest stars, and Nietzsche is a nova as dazzling as it is short-lived, the latest to join them, and spurred on, like them, no doubt, by a characteristically Christian concern for the authenticity of the stirrings of the soul. Freud was able to precipitate a whole causatory into a map of tundra in which one couldn't care less about an orientation for the offices for which it was intended. Its objectivity is, in fact, strictly tied to the analytic situation, which, within the four walls that limit its field, can do very well without people knowing which way is north, since they confuse north with the long axis of the couch, assumed to point in the direction of the analyst. Psychoanalysis is the science of the mirages that arise within this field, a unique experience, a rather abject one at that, but one that cannot be too highly recommended to those who wish to get to the crux of mankind's forms of madness, for while revealing itself to be akin to a whole range of alienations, it sheds light on them. This language is moderate enough. I'm not the one who invented it. I have even heard a zealot of supposedly classical psychoanalysis define the latter as an experience whose privilege is strictly tied to the forms that regulate its practice, forms that cannot be altered one iota because, having been obtained by means of a miracle of chance, they provide access to a reality that transcends the phenomena of history, a reality in which a taste for order and a love of beauty, for example, find their permanent ground, namely, the objects of the pre-Oedipal relation, shit, and all that crap, other crap. This position cannot be refuted since its rules are justified by their outcomes, and the latter are taken as proof that the rules are well-founded. Yet our questions proliferate anew. How does this prodigious miracle of chance occur? Whence stems this contradiction between the pre-Oedipal mess to which the analytic relationship can be reduced, according to our modern analysts, and the fact that Freud wasn't satisfied until he had reduced it to the Oedipal position? How can the sort of hothouse auscultation on which this new look of analytic experience borders be the final stage in a development that appeared at the outset to open up multiple paths among all the fields of creation? Or, the same question put the other way around, if the objects discerned in this elective fermentation were thus discovered through some other pathway, then that of experimental psychology, is experimental psychology qualified to rediscover them through its own procedures? The replies we will receive from the interested parties leave no room for doubt. The motor force of analytic experience, even when explained in their terms, cannot simply be this mirage-like truth that can be reduced to the mirage of truth. It all began with a particular truth, an unveiling, the effect of which is that reality is no longer the same way for us as it was before. This is what continues to attach the crazy cacophony of theory to the very heart of worldly things, and to prevent practice from degenerating to the level of the wretched who never managed to leave them behind. It should be understood that I am using the term to exclude cynics. A truth, if it must be said, is not easy to recognize once it has become received. Not that there aren't any established truths, but they are so easily confused with the reality that surrounds them that no other artifice was for a long time found to distinguish them from it and to mark them with the sign of the spirit, and in order to pay them homage, to regard them as having come from another world. It is not the whole story to attribute to a sort of blindness on man's part the fact that truth is never to him a finer looking girl than when the light held aloft by his arm, as in the proverbial emblem, unexpectedly illuminates her nakedness. And one must play the fool a bit to feign knowing nothing of what happens next. But stupidity remains characterized by bull-headed frankness when one wonders where one could have been looking for her before, the emblem scarcely helping to indicate the well, an unseemly and even malodorous place, rather than the jewellery box in which every precious form must be preserved intact. The thing speaks of itself. But now, the truth in Freud's mouth takes the said bull by the horns. To you, I am thus the enigma of she who slips away as soon as she appears. You men who try so hard to hide me under the tawdry finery of your properties. Still, I admit your embarrassment is sincere, for even when you take it upon yourselves to become my heralds, you acquire no greater worth by hearing my colours than your own clothes, which are like you, phantoms that you are. Where am I going, having passed into you, and where was I prior to that? Will I perhaps tell you some day? But so that you will find me where I am, I will teach you by what sign you can recognize me. Men, listen, I am telling you the secret. I, truth, speak. Must I point out that you did not yet know this? Of course, some of you who proclaim yourselves my lovers, no doubt because of the principle that one is never better served than by oneself in this kind of boasting, have posited, in an ambiguous manner, and not without revealing the clumsiness brought on by the vanity that they were really concerned about, that the errors of philosophy, that is, their own, could subsist only on my subsidies. Yet having embraced these daughters of their thought, they eventually found them as insipid as they were futile, and began associating anew with opinions considered to be vulgar according to the moral standards of the sages of old. The latter knew how to put such opinions, whether narratives litigious, guileful, or simply mendacious, in their place, but also to seek them out in the home and in the forum, at the forge and at the fair. They then realized that, by not being my parasites, these opinions seem to be serving me far better, and who knows, even to be acting as my militia, the secret agents of my power. Several cases observed in certain games of sudden transformations of error into truth, which seemed to be due only to perseverance, set them on the path of this discovery. The discourse of error, its articulation in action, could bear witness to the truth against the apparent facts themselves. It was then that one of them tried to get the cunning of reason accepted into the rank of objects deemed worthy of study. Unfortunately, he was a professor, and you were only too happy to listen to his teachings with the dunce caps you were made to wear at school, and which have since served as ear trumpets for those of you who are a bit deaf. Remain content, then, with your vague sense of history, and leave it to clever people to found the whole world in the world markets in lies, the trade in all-out war, and the new law of self-criticism on the guarantee of my future firm. If reason is as cunning as Hegel said it was, it will do its job without your help. But for all that, you haven't rendered what you owe me obsolete or endlessly postponable. It falls due after yesterday and before tomorrow, and it hardly matters whether you rush ahead to honour or evade it, since it will grab you from behind in both cases. Whether you flee me in deceit or think you can catch me in error, I will catch up with you in the mistake from which you cannot hide. Where the most cunning speech reveals a slight stumbling, it doesn't live up to its perfidy. I am now publicly announcing the fact, and it will be a bit harder after this to act as if nothing is happening, whether in good company or bad. But there is no need to wear yourselves out, keeping a closer watch on yourselves. Even if the combined jurisdictions of politeness and politics declare that whatever claims to be associated with me is inadmissible when it presents itself in such an illicit manner, you would not get off so lightly, for the most innocent intention is disconcerted once it can no longer conceal the fact that one's bungled actions are the most successful, and that one's failures fulfill one's most secret wishes. In any case, doesn't my escape first from the dungeon of the fortress in which you think you are most sure to hold me, by situating me not in yourselves but in being itself, suffice to prove your defeat? I wonder about in what you regard as least true by its very nature, in dreams, in the way the most far-fetched witticisms and the most grotesque nonsense of jokes defy meaning, and in chance, not in its law, but rather in its contingency, and I nevermore surely proceed to change the face of the world than when I gave it the profile of Cleopatra's nose. You can therefore reduce the traffic on the roads that you strove so hard to prove radiate from consciousness, and which were the ego's pride and joy, crowned by Fichte with the insignias of its transcendence. The long-term trade in truth no longer involves thought. Strangely enough, it now seems to involve things, rebus. It is through you that I communicate, as Freud formulates it at the end of the first paragraph of the sixth chapter, devoted to the dream work of his work on dreams and what dreams mean. But you must be careful here. The hard time Freud had becoming a professor will perhaps spare me him your neglect, if not your deviation. The prosopopoeia continues. Listen carefully to what he says, and, as he said it, of me, the truth that speaks. The best way to grasp it is to take it literally. Here, no doubt, things are my signs, but I repeat, signs of my speech. If Cleopatra's nose changed the world's course, it was because it entered the world's discourse. For in order to change it, for the longer or the shorter, it was sufficient, but it was also necessary that it be a speaking nose. But it is your own nose that you must now use, albeit for more natural ends. Let a sense of smell surer than all your categories guide you in the race to which I challenge you. For if the cunning of reason, however disdainful it may have been of you, remained open to your faith, I, truth, will against you be the great trickster, since I slip in not only via falsehood, but through a crack too narrow to be found at feigning's weakest point, and through the dream's inaccessible cloud, through the groundless fascination with mediocrity and the seductive impasse of absurdity. Seek, dogs that you become upon hearing me, bloodhounds that Sophocles referred to put on the scent of the hermetic traces of Apollo's thief, than on Oedipus's bleeding heels. certain as he was of finding the moment of truth with him at the sinister meeting at Colonus. Enter the lists at my call, and howl at the sound of my voice. Now that you are already lost, I belie myself, I defy you, I slip away. You say that I am being defensive. Parade. The return to darkness, which I think must be expected at this moment, is the signal for a murder party. That beings, with an order forbidding everyone to leave, since anyone may now be hiding the truth under her dress or even in her womb, as in the amorous fiction, The Indiscreet Jewels. The general question is, who is speaking? And the question is not an irrelevant one. Unfortunately, the answers given are a bit hasty. First, the libido is accused, which leads us in the direction of the jewels. But we must realize that the ego itself, although it fetters the libido, which pines for satisfaction, is sometimes the object of the libido's undertakings. One senses that the ego is about to collapse any minute when the sound of broken glass informs everyone that it is a large drawing room mirror that has sustained the accident, the golem of narcissism, hastily invoked to assist the ego, having thereby made its entrance. The ego is then generally regarded as the assassin, if not the victim. The upshot being that the divine rays of the good President Schreiber begin to spread their net over the world, and the Sabbath of the instincts becomes truly complicated. The comedy which I shall interrupt here at the beginning of its second act is less mean-spirited than is usually believed, since, attributing to a drama of knowledge a buffoonery that belongs only to those who act in this drama without understanding it, restores to such people the authenticity from which they had fallen away ever further. But if a more serious metaphor befits the protagonist, it is one that would show us in Freud an acteon perpetually set upon by dogs that are thrown off the scent right from the outset, dogs that he strives to get back on his tail without being able to slow the race in which only his passion for the goddess leads him on. It leads him on so far that he cannot stop until he reaches the cave in which the Thonian Diana, in the damp shade that confounds the cave with the emblematic abode of truth, offers to his thirst, along with the smooth surface of death, the quasi-mystical limit of the most rational discourse the world has ever heard, so that we might recognize there the locus in which the symbol substitutes for death in order to take possession of the first budding of life. As we know, this limit and this locus are still far from being reached by his disciples when they don't simply refuse to follow him there altogether. And so the acteon who is dismembered here is not Freud, but every analyst in proportion to the passion that inflamed him and made him, according to the signification Giordano Bruno drew from this myth in his heroic frenzies, the prey of the dogs of his own thoughts. To gauge the extent of this rending, we must hear the irrepressible protests that arise from both the best and the worst when one tries to bring them back to the beginning of the hunt with the words that truth gave us as a vieticum. I speak, adding, there is no speech without language. Their tumult drowns out what follows. Logomachia goes to the strophe on one side. What do you make of the pre-verbal gestures and facial expressions, tone, melody, mood, and affective contact, to which others no less vehement give the antistrophe? Everything is language. Language when my heart beats faster as fear strikes, and if my patient faints at the roar of an aeroplane at its zenith, it is a way of telling me the memories she still has of the last bombing. Yes, eagle of thought, And when the plane's shape cuts out your semblance in the night-piercing beam of the searchlight, it is heaven's response. Yet in trying out these premises, people did not challenge the use of any of the forms of communication people might resort to in their exploits, neither signals nor images, content nor form, content nor form, whether man or woman, even if this content were one of sympathy, the virtue of any proper form not being debated. They began merely to repeat after Freud the key to his discovery. It speaks precisely where it was least expected, namely where it suffers. If there ever was a time when, to respond to it, it sufficed to listen to what it was saying, for the reason, for the answer is already there in hearing it. Let us assume that the great ones of the early days, the armchair giants, were struck by the curse that befalls titanic acts of daring, or that their chairs ceased to be conductors of the good word which they were vested to sit before. Be that as it may, since then, there have been more meetings between the psychoanalyst and psychoanalysis, in the hope that the Athenian would reach his apex with Athena having emerged fully armed from Freud's head. Shall I tell you of the jealous fate, ever the same, that thwarted these meetings, behind the mask where each of us was to meet his betrothed, alas, thrice alas, and a cry of horror at the thought of it, another woman having taken her place. He who was there was not him either. Let us thus calmly return and spell out with the truth what it said of itself. The truth said, I speak, in order for us to recognize this I on the basis of the fact that it speaks. Perhaps we should not have jumped on the I, but should have paused at the facets of the speaking. There is no speech without language. Reminds us that language is an order constituted by laws about which we could at least return with, about which we could at least learn what they exclude. For example, that language is different from natural expression, and that it is not a code either. That language is not the same as information. Take a close look at cybernetics, and you'll see the difference. And that language is so far from being reducible to a superstructure that materialism itself was alarmed by this heresy. See Stalin's pronouncement on the question. Should you like to know more about it, read Saussure. And since a bell tower can hide even the sun. Let me make it clear that I am not referring to Saussure of psychoanalytic repute, but to Ferdinand, who may be said to be the founder of modern linguistics. The Thing's Order. A psychoanalyst should find it easy to grasp the fundamental distinction between signifier and signified, and to begin to familiarize himself with the two networks of the non-overlapping relations they organize. The first network, that of the signifier, is the synchronic structure of the material of language insofar as each element takes on its precise usage therein by being different from the others. This is the principle of distribution that alone regulates the function of the elements of language. At its different levels, from the phonemic pair of oppositions to compound expressions, the task of the most modern research being to isolate the stable forms of the latter. The second network, that of the signified, is the diachronic set of concretely pronounced discourses which historically affects the first network, just as the structure of the first governs the pathway of the pathways of the second. What dominates here is the unity of signification, which turns out to never come down to a pure indication of reality, but always refers to another signification. In other words, signification comes about only on the basis of taking things as the whole. Its mainspring cannot be grasped at the level at which signification usually secures its characteristic redundancy, for it always proves to exceed the things it leaves indeterminate within it. The signifier alone guarantees the theoretical coherence of the whole as a whole. Its ability to do so is confirmed by the latest developments in science, just as, upon reflection, we find it to be implicit in early linguistic experience. These are the foundations that distinguish language from signs. Dialectic derives new strength from them. For the remark on which Hegel bases his critique of the beautiful soul, according to which it is said to live, in every sense, even the economic sense of having something to live off of, precisely off the disorder it denounces, escapes being tautological only by maintaining the tautontic of the beautiful soul as mediation, unrecognized by itself, of this disorder as being in primary, as primary in being. However dialectical it may be, this remark cannot shake up the delusion of presumption to which Hegel applied it, remaining caught in the trap offered by the mirage of consciousness to the eye, infatuated with its own feeling, which Hegel turns into the law of the heart. Of course, this I in Hegel is defined as a legal being, making it more concrete than the real being from which people formerly thought it could be abstracted, as is clear from the fact that it implies both a civil status and an account status. But it was left to Freud to make this legal being responsible for the disorder manifest in the most tightly closed field of the real being, namely in the organism's pseudo-totality. I explain this possibility by the congenital gap presented by man's real being in his natural relations by the reprising in a sometimes ideographic but also phonetic and even grammatical usage of the imaginary elements that appear to be fragmented in this gap. But we have no need for this genesis to demonstrate the symptoms signifying structure. Once deciphered, it is plain to see and shows the omnipresence for human beings of the symbolic function stamped on the flesh. What distinguishes a society grounded in language from an animal society, which even the ethnological standpoint allows us to see, namely, the fact that the exchange that characterizes such a society has other foundations than needs, even if it satisfies them, specifically, what has been called the gift as total social fact, can then be taken much further, as far as to constitute an objection to defining this society as a collection of individuals, since the immixing of subjects makes it a group with a very different structure. This reintroduces the impact of truth as cause from a totally different angle and requires a reappraisal of the process of causality, the first stage of which seem to be to recognize the degree to which the heterogeneity of this impact is inherent. It is strange that materialist thought seems to forget that it derived its impetus from this recourse to the heterogeneous. More interest might then be shown in a feature that is more striking than the resistance to Freud mounted by the pedants, namely the connivance this resistance encountered in collective consciousness. If all causality evinces the subject's involvement, it will come as no surprise that every order conflict is attributed to him. The terms in which I am posing the problem of psychoanalytic intervention make it sufficiently clear, I think, that its ethics are not individualistic, but its practice in the American sphere has so summarily degenerated into a means of obtaining success and into a mode of demanding happiness, that it must be pointed out that this constitutes a repudiation of psychoanalysis, a repudiation that occurs among too many of its adherents due to the pure and simple fact that they have never wanted to know anything about Freud's discovery, and that they will never know anything about it, even in the way implied by repression. For what is at work here is the mechanism of systematic misrecognition, insofar as it simulates delusion, even in its group forms. But had analytic experience been more rigorously linked to the general structure of semantics in which it has its roots, it would have allowed us to convince them before having to vanquish them. For the subject of whom I was just speaking as the legatee of recognized truth is definitely not the ego perceptible in the more or less immediate data of conscious jouissance or the alienation of labor. This de facto distinction is the same distinction found from the beginning to the end of Freud's work from the Freudian unconscious, insofar as it is separated by a profound gulf from the preconscious functions, the Freud's last will and testament in lecture 31 of his New Vorlesungen, new introductory lectures. Wo es war soll ich werden? A formulation in which signifying structuration clearly prevails. Let us analyze it. Contrary to the form that the English translation, where the id was, there the ego shall be, cannot avoid. Freud said neither das es nor das ich, as was his wont when designating the agencies he had used to organize his new topography for the previous 10 years, and considering the inflexible rigor of his style, this gives a particular emphasis to their use in this sentence. In any case, even without having to confirm through the detailed examination of Freud's opus that he in fact wrote das Ich und das Es, the ego and the id, in order to maintain the fundamental distinction between the true subject of the unconscious and the ego, as constituted in its nucleus by a series of alienating identifications. It seems here that it is the locus, wo, where, es, the subject devoid of any das or other objectifying article, war, was. It is a locus of being that is at stake, and that in this locus, soul, it is a duty in the moral sense that is announced here, as is confirmed by the single sentence that follows it, bringing the chapter to a close. Ich, I, there must I, just as in French, one announced, c'est suis je, it is I, before saying, c'est moi, it's me. Werden, become, not occur, or even happen, but be born of this very locus insofar as it is a locus of being. Even though it runs counter to the principles of economy of expression that must dominate a translation, I would thus agree to force the forms of the signifier a little in French in order to bring them into line with the weight of a still refractory signification, which the German tolerates better here. To do so, I would play on the homophony between the German S and the first letter of the word subject. By the same token, I might feel more indulgent, at least momentarily, toward the first French translation that was provided by the word S, namely, le soi, the self, the ça, the it or the id, which was eventually preferred, not groundlessly, does not seem to me to be much better, since it is rather to the German das in the question, was ist das, that it corresponds in das ist, the elided C that appears if we stick to the accepted equivalence, thus suggests to me the production of the verb c'est à toi, which would express the mode of absolute subjectivity, insofar as Freud truly discovered it in its radical eccentricity, where it was, one might say, where it was itself, as I would like it to be heard, is my duty that I come into being. You should realize that the point is not to analyze if and how the I and the ego are distinct and overlap in such particular subject on the basis of a grammatical conception of their functions. What a linguistic conception which must shape the analytic worker in his basic initiation will teach him is to expect the symptom to prove its signifying function, that is, that by which it differs from the natural index commonly designated by the term symptom in medicine, and in order to satisfy this methodological requirement, he will oblige himself to recognize its conventional use in the significations brought out by analytic dialogue, a dialogue whose structure I shall try to articulate, that he will maintain that these very significations can be grasped with certainty only in their context, that is, and the sequence constituted for each one of them by the signification that refers back to it, and the signification to which it refers in analytic discourse. These basic principles can be easily applied in analytic technique, and, in elucidating it, they dissipate many of the ambiguities which, being maintained even in the major concepts of transference and resistance, make the use that is made of them in practice exceedingly costly. Resistance to the registers. To consider only resistance, whose use is increasingly confused with that of defense, and all the latter thus implies by way of maneuvers designed to eliminate it, maneuvers whose coercive nature we can no longer ignore. It is worth recalling that the first resistance analysis faces is that of discourse itself, insofar as it is, first of all, a discourse of opinion, and that all psychological objectification proves to be intimately tied to this discourse. This is, in effect, what motivated the remarkable simultaneity with which the psychoanalytic practice of the Burgraves of analysis came to a standstill in the 1920s, for by then they knew both too much and not enough about it to get their patients, who scarcely knew less about it, to recognize the truth. But the principle adopted at that time of granting primacy to the analysis of resistance hardly led to a favorable development. The reason that giving top priority to an operation doesn't suffice to make it reach its objective when one is unclear as to what that objective is. Now, the analysis of resistance was designed precisely to reinforce the subject's objectifying position to so great an extent, indeed, that this directive now permeates the principles that are supposed to be applied in the conduct of a standard treatment. Far from having to maintain the subject in a state of self-observation, therefore, one must know that by inviting him to adopt such a position, one enters a circle of misunderstanding that nothing in the treatment, or even in the analytic literature, will be able to shatter. Any intervention that moves in this direction can thus only be justified by a dialectical aim, namely, to demonstrate that it amounts to an impasse. But I will go further and say that you cannot both carry out the subjectification of the subject yourself and to speak to him as you should, and for a reason, which is not simply that you can't, as the English proverb has it, have your cake and eat it too, that is, adopt two different approaches to the same objects, whose consequences are mutually exclusive. But for the deeper reason that is expressed in the saying, you can't serve two masters, that is, conform your being to two actions that lead in opposite directions. For objectification in psychological matters is subject at its very core to a law of misrecognition that governs the subject not only as observed, but also as observer. In other words, it is not about him that you must speak to him, for he can do this well enough himself, and in doing so, it is not even to you that he speaks. While it is to him that you must speak, it is literally about something else, that is, about something other than what is at stake when he speaks of himself, which is the thing that speaks to you. Regardless of what he says, this thing will remain forever inaccessible to him. If, being speech addressed to you, it cannot elicit its response in you, and if, having heard its message in this inverted form, you cannot, in returning to it to him, give him the twofold satisfaction of having recognized it and of making him recognize its truth. Can't we then know the truth that we know in this way? Adequatio rei et intellectus. Thus has the concept of truth been defined since there were thinkers who led us into the pathways of their thought. Intellects, like ours, will certainly measure up to the thing that speaks to us, nay, that speaks in us, and even when it hides behind a discourse that says nothing merely to make us speak, It would be shocking indeed if the thing did not find someone to speak to. I hope you will be so lucky. We must speak it about it now, and those who put the thing into practice have the floor. Interlude. But don't expect too much here, for ever since the psychoanalytic thing became an acceptable thing, its servants started having their hands manicured. The house cleaning they have been performing makes do with sacrifices to good taste, which as far as ideas, which psychoanalysts have never had in abundance, are concerned, is certainly convenient. Ideas on sale for everyone will make up the balance of what each person is lacking in. We are sufficiently abreast of things to know that cosisme is hardly in good taste, which is our way of sidestepping the question. Why go off in search of something other than the ego you distinguish when you forbid us to see it? It may be objected. So we objectify it. What's wrong with that? Here, the delicate shoes move stealthily forward to deliver the following kick in the face. Do you think, then, that the ego can be taken as a thing? We'd never entertain any such notion. From 35 years of cohabitation with the ego under the roof of the second Freudian topography, including 10 years of a rather stormy relationship, finally legitimized by the ministry of Miss Anna Freud in a marriage whose social credit has done nothing but grow ever since, so much so that people assure me it will soon request the church's blessing. In short, from the most sustained work of psychoanalysts, you will draw nothing more than this drawer. It is true that it is a chock full of old novelties and new antiques, the sheer mass of which is at least entertaining. The ego is a function. The ego is a synthesis of function, a function of synthesis. It is autonomous. That's a good one. It's the latest fetish introduced into the holy of holies of a practice that is legitimately by the superiority of the superiors. It does the job as well as any other, everyone realizing that it is always the most outmoded, dirty, and repulsive object that best fulfills this function being entirely real. That this object should gain for its inventor the veneration it does where it is in operation is just barely tolerable. But the most amazing thing is that in enlightened circles it has earned him the prestige of having returned psychoanalysis to the fold of the laws of general psychology. It is as if His Excellency, the Aga Khan, not content with receiving his weight in gold, which in no way diminishes the esteem in which he is held in cosmopolitan society, were to be awarded the Nobel Prize for, in exchange, distributing to his followers the precise rules for pari mutuel. But the latest find is the best. The ego, like everything else we have been handling of late in the human sciences, is an operational notion. At this point, I appeal, before those in the audience, to this naive chosisme. I pronounced cosisme before cosisme, which keeps them sitting so properly in their seats, listening to me despite the barrage of calls to serve, so that they might, with me, agree to put a stop to this op. In what respect does this op rationally distinguish what one makes of the notion of the ego in analysis from the common usage of any other thing of this lectern? To take the first thing at hand, it distinguishes them so little that I am confident I can show that the discourses about them, and that is what is at stake, coincide point for point. For this lectern, no less than the ego, is dependent on the signifier, namely on the word, which, generalizing its function compared to the pulpit, quarrelsome memory into the truncheon table of noble pedigree, is responsible for the fact that it is not merely a tree that has been felled, cut down to size, and glued back together by a cabinet maker, for reasons of commerce tied to need creating fashions that maintain its exchange value, assuming it is not led too quickly to satisfy the least superfluous of those needs by the final use to which wear and tear will eventually reduce it, namely, fuel for the fire. Moreover, the significations to which the lectern refers are in no way less dignified than those of the ego, and the proof is that they occasionally envelop the ego itself. If it is by the functions Heinz Hartmann attributes to the ego that one of our semblables may become our lectern, namely, maintain a position suitable enough for him to consent to it, an operational function, no doubt, that will allow the said semblable to display within himself all the possible values of this lectern as a thing, from the hefty rent charged for its use that kept and still keeps the standing of the little hunchback of the Rue Quincampoix, above both the vicissitudes and the very memory of the first great speculative crash of modern times, for all the purposes of everyday convenience of furnishing a room, of transfer for cash, or assignment of interest to its use. And why not? It has happened before, as firewood. But that isn't all, for I am willing to lend my voice to the true lectern so that it might deliver a lecture on its existence, which, even though it is instrumental, is individual, on its history, which, however radically alienated it may seem to us, has left all the written traces a historian might require, documents, texts, and bills from suppliers, and on its very destiny, which, though inert, is dramatic, since a lectern is perishable, is engendered by labour, and has a fate subject to chance, obstacles, misadventures, prestige, and even fatalities whose index it becomes, and it is destined to an end for which it need know nothing for it to be the lectern's own, since we all know what it is. But it would be nothing more than sheer banality if, after this prosopopoeia, one of you dreams that he is this lectern, whether or not it is endowed with the gift of speech. And since the interpretation of dreams has become a well-known, if not a widespread practice, there would be no reason to be surprised if, by deciphering the use of it, the use as a signifier that this lectern has taken on in the rebus in which the dreamer immures his desire, and by analysing the more or less equivocal reference implied by this use to the significations the lectern's consciousness has awakened in him, with or without its lecture, we reached what might be called the lectern's preconscious. At this point, I hear a protest, which I am not sure how to name, even though it is totally predictable, for in effect, it concerns that which has no name in any language, and which, generally manifesting itself in the ambiguous, mollifying motion of the total personality, comprises everything that leads us to the publicly ridiculed in psychiatry for our worthless phenomenology and in society for our stationary progressiveness or progressivism. The protest is that of the beautiful soul, no doubt, but in form suited to the wishy-washy being, wry manner, tenebrous approach of the modern intellectual, whether on the right or left. Indeed, it is in this quarter that the fictional protest of those that disorder causes to proliferate finds its noble alliances. Let us listen rather to the tone of this protest. The tone is measured but serious. Neither the preconscious nor consciousness, we are told, belongs to the lectern, but to we who perceive the desk and give it its meaning. All the more easily, moreover, since we ourselves have made the thing. But even if a more natural being were at stake, we should never thoughtlessly debase in consciousness the high form which, however feeble we may be in the universe, assures us an imprescriptible dignity in it. Look up a Reed in the Dictionary of Spiritualist Thought. I must admit that Freud incites me to be irreverent here by the way in which, in a passing remark somewhere,
as if without touching on it. He speaks about the modes of spontaneous provocation that are usual when universal consciousness goes into action, and this relieves me of any constraint about pursuing my paradox. Is the difference between the lectern and us, as far as consciousness is concerned, so very great then if, in being brought into play between you and me, the lectern can so easily acquire a semblance of consciousness that my sentences could allow us to mistake the one for the other? Being placed with one of us between two parallel mirrors, it will be seen to reflect indefinitely, which means that it will be far more like the person who is looking than we think, since in seeing his image repeated in the same way, he too truly sees himself through another's eyes when he looks at himself, since without the other, his image, he would not see himself seeing himself. In other words, the ego's privileged status compared to things must be sought elsewhere than in this false recurrence to infinity of the reflection which constitutes the mirage of consciousness, and which, despite its utter uselessness, still titillates those who work with thought enough for them to see in it some supposed progress in interiority, whereas it is a topological phenomenon whose distribution in nature is as sporadic as the dispositions of pure exteriority that condition it, even if it is true that man has helped spread them with such immoderate frequency. How, moreover, can we separate the term preconscious from the affectations of this lectern, or from those which are potentially or actually found in any other thing, and which, by adjusting themselves so exactly to my affections, will become conscious along with them? I am willing to accept that the ego and not the lectern is the seat of perceptions, but it thus reflects the essence of the objects it perceives, and not its own essence. Insofar as consciousness is supposedly its privilege, since these perceptions are, for the most part, unconscious. It is no accident, moreover, that I have detected the origin of the protest that I must address here in the bastardized forms of phenomenology that cloud the technical analyses of human action, especially those required in medicine, if they're cheap material, to borrow the term. A term Jaspers uses in his assessment of psychoanalysis really is what gives his work its style and its weight to him as the epitome of the cast-iron spiritual advisor and tinplate guru. They are not useless. Indeed, their use is always the same, namely, to create a diversion. They are used here, for example, in order to avoid discussing the important point that the lectern does not talk, which the upholders of the false protest want to know nothing about, because my lectern, hearing me grant them the point, would immediately begin to speak. The Other's Discourse. In what way, then, is the ego you treat in analysis better than the lectern that I am? It would ask them. For if its health is defined by its adaptation to a reality that is quite frankly regarded as being measured against the ego, and if you need the alliance of the healthy part of the ego in order to eliminate discordances with reality, in the other part of the ego, no doubt, which only appear to be discordances due to your principle of regarding the analytic situation as simple and innocuous, and concerning which you won't stop until you have made the subject see them as you see them. Isn't it clear that there is no way to discern which is the healthy part of the subject's ego, except by its agreement with your point of view? And, since the latter is assumed to be healthy, it becomes the measure of all things. Isn't it similarly clear that there is no other criterion of cure than the complete adoption by the subject of your measure? This is confirmed by the common admission by certain serious authors that the end of analysis is achieved when the subject identifies with the analyst's ego. Certainly, the fact that such a view can be spread and be accepted so calmly leads one to think that, contrary to the commonly held view, that it is easy to impress the naive, it is much easier for the naive to impress others. And The hypocrisy revealed in the declaration, whose repentant tone appears with such curious regularity in this discourse, that we should speak to the subject in his own language, gives one still further pause for thought regarding the depth of this naivety. We still have to overcome the nausea we feel at the idea it suggests of employing baby talk, without which well-informed parents would believe themselves incapable of inculcating their lofty reasons in the poor little guys that have to be made to keep quiet. These are simple attentions people consider necessary because, according to the notion projected by analytic imbecility, neurotics supposedly have weak egos. But we are not here to dream about nausea and vertigo. The fact remains, although I may be a mere lectern in speaking to you, I am the ideal patient, for not so much trouble has to be taken with me. The results are obtained immediately. I am cured in advance. Since the point is simple to replace my discourse with yours, I am a perfect ego. Since I have never had any other discourse, and I leave it to you to inform me of the things to which my adjustment controls do not allow you to adapt me directly, namely, of everything other than your eyesight, your height, and the dimensions of your papers. Not a bad speech for a lectern, I'd say. I must be kidding, of course. In what it said under my command, it did not have its say. For the reason that it itself was a word, it was me, as grammatical subject. Well, that's one rank achieved, one worth being picked up by the opportunistic soldier in the ditch of an entirely aristic claim, but which also provides us with an illustration of the Freudian motto, which expressed as "là où était ça léger deux à trois." I don't really know if it says that, so sorry. Would confirm to our benefit the feeble character of a translation that substantifies the ich by giving a t to deut, translating soul, and fixes the price of the s according to the rate of the c. The fact remains that the lectern is not an ego, however eloquent it was, but a means that I have employed in my discourse. But after all, if we envision its virtue in analysis, the ego too is a means, and they can be compared. As the lectern so pertinently mentioned, it has the advantage over the ego of not being a means of resistance, and that's precisely why I chose it to prop up my discourse and proportionately mitigate whatever resistance a greater interference of my ego and Freud's words might have given rise to in you, satisfied as I would already be if the resistance you must be left with, despite this effacement, led you to find what I am saying interesting. It's no accident that this expression, in its euphemistic use, designates what interests us only moderately and manages to come full circle in its antithesis, by which speculations of universal interest are called disinterested. But were what I am saying to come to interest you personally, as they say, filling out an ontonomasia with a pleonasm, the lectern would soon be in pieces for us to use as a weapon. Well, all of that applies to the ego, except that its uses seem to be reversed in their relation to its states. The ego is a means of the speech addressed to you from the subject's unconscious, a weapon for resisting its recognition. It is fragmented when it conveys speech, and whole when it serves not to hear it. Indeed, the subject finds the signifying material of his symptoms in the disintegration of the imaginary unity that the ego constitutes, and it is from the sort of interest the ego awakens in him that come the significations that turn his discourse away from it. This interest in the ego is a passion whose nature was already glimpsed by the traditional moralists who called it, sorry, I'll go back, it's called imaginary passion. This interest in the ego is a passion whose nature was already glimpsed by the traditional moralists who called it amor proper, but whose dynamics in relation to one's own body image only psychoanalytic investigation could analyze. This passion brings to every relation with this image, constantly represented by my semblable, a signification which interests me so greatly, that is, which makes me so dependent on this image, that it links all the objects of my desires to the other's desire more closely than to the desire they arouse in me. I'm talking about objects as we expect them to appear in a space structured by vision, that is, objects characteristic of the human world. As to the knowledge on which desire for these objects depends, men are far from confirming the expression that says they see no further than the end of their nose. On the contrary, their misfortune is such that their world begins at the end of their nose, and they can apprehend their desire only by means of the same thing that allows them to see their nose itself, a mirror. But no sooner has this nose been discerned than they fall in love with it, and this is the first signification by which narcissism envelops the forms of desire. It is not the only signification, and the growing importance of aggressiveness and the firmament of analytic concerns would remain obscure if we confined our attention to this one alone. This is a point I believe I myself have helped elucidate by conceptualizing the so-called dynamics of the mirror stage. As the consequence of man's generic prematurity at birth, leading at the age indicated to the jubilant identification of the individual who is still an infant, with the total form in which this reflection of the nose is integrated, namely, with the image of his body. This operation, which is carried out in an approximate manner that might be taken off by a nose, an apt expression here, in other words, falling more or less into the same category as the aha that enlightens us about the chimpanzee's intelligence, amazed as we always are to detect the miracle of intelligence on our peers' faces, does not fail to bring deplorable consequences in its wake. As a witty poet so rightly remarks, the mirror would do well to reflect a little more before sending us back our image, for at this point the subject has not yet seen anything, but let the same capture be reproduced under the nose of one of his semblables, the nose of a notary, for example, and Lord knows where the subject will be led by the nose, given the places such legal professionals are in the habit of sticking theirs, and whatever else we have, hands, feet, heart, mouth, even the eyes, that is so reluctant to follow, is threatened by a breaking up of the team whose announcement through anxiety could only lead to severe measures. Regroup and appeal to the power of this image, which made the honeymoon with the mirror so jubilant, to the sacred union of right and left that is affirmed in it, as inverted as it may appear to be, should the subject prove to be a bit more observant. But what finer model of this union is there than the very image of the other, that is, of the notary in his function? It is thus that the functions of mastery, improperly called the ego's synthetic functions, institute, on the basis of libidinal alienation, the subsequent development, namely, what I formerly termed the paranoiac principle of human knowledge, according to which man's objects are subjected to a law of imaginary reduplication, evoking ratification by an indefinite series of notaries which owes nothing to their professional federation. but the signification that strikes me is decisive in the constitutive alienation of the ego's Urbild appears in the relation of exclusion that henceforth structures the dyadic ego-to-ego relationship in the subject. For should the imaginary coaptation of the one to the other bring about a complementary distribution of roles between, for example, the notary and the notarized party, an effect of the ego's precipitated identification with the other in the subject is that this distribution never constitutes even a kinetic harmony, but is instituted on the basis of a permanent it's you or me form of war in which the existence of one or the other of the two notaries in each of the subjects is at stake. This situation is symbolized in the so are you of the transitivist quarrel, the original form of aggressive communication. We can see to what the ego's language is reduced. Intuitive illumination, recollective command, and the retorting aggressiveness of verbal ego. Echo. The retorting aggressiveness of verbal echo. Let us add to this what the ego receives from the automatic scraps of everyday discourse, rote learning and delusional reframe, modes of communication perfectly reproduced by objects scarcely more complicated than this lectern, a feedback construction for the former, a gramophone record preferably scratched in the right place for the latter. It is nevertheless in this register that the systematic analysis of defense is proffered. It is corroborated by semblances of regression. The object relation provides appearances of it, and this forcing has no other outcome than one of the three allowed by the technique currently in force: either the impulsive leap into reality through the hoop of fantasy, acting out in a direction that is ordinarily the opposite of suggestion, or transitory hypomania due to ejection of the object itself, which is correctly described in the megalomaniacal intoxication which my friend Michael Balint, an account so voracious as to make him a still better friend, recognizes as the index of the termination of an analysis according to current norms, or in the sort of somatization constituted by mild hypochondria, discreetly theorized under the heading of the doctor-patient relationship. The dimension of a two-body psychology, suggested by Rickman, is the fantasy in which two ego analyses hides, which is as untenable as it is coherent in its results. Analytic action. This is why I teach that there are not only two subjects present in the analytic situation, but two subjects, each of whom is provided with two objects, the ego and the other, the latter being with a lowercase o. Now, due to the singularities of a dialectical mathematics with which we must familiarize ourselves, their union in the pair of subjects, capital S and capital A, includes only four terms in all, because the relation of exclusion that obtains between little a and little a apostrophe reduces the two couples thus indicated to a single couple in the juxtaposition of the subjects. In this game for four players, the analyst will act on the significant resistances that weigh down, impede, and divert speech, while himself introducing into the quartet the primordial sign of the exclusion that connotes the either-or of presence or absence, which formally brings out death as included in the narcissistic Bildung. This sign is lacking, let it be noted in passing, in the algorithmic apparatus of the modern logic that is called symbolic, demonstrating the dialectical inadequacy that renders it still unsuitable for formalizing the human sciences. This means that the analyst concretely intervenes in the dialectic of analysis by playing dead, by cadaverizing his position, as the Chinese say, either by his silence, where he is the big other with a capital O, or by cancelling out his own resistance, where he is the other with a lowercase o in both cases, and via symbolic imaginary effects, respectively, he makes death present. Still, he must recognize and therefore distinguish his action in each of these two registers to know why he is intervening, at what moment the opportunity is presenting itself, and how to act on it. The primordial condition for this is that the analyst should be thoroughly convinced by the radical difference between the other to whom his speech should be addressed and the second other, who is the one he sees before him, about whom and by means of whom the first speaks to him in the discourse it pursues before him. For in this way, the analyst will be able to be the one to whom this discourse is addressed. The fable of my lectern and the usual practice of the discourse of conviction will show him clearly enough, if he thinks about it, that no word, whatever inertia it may be based on or whatever passion it may appeal to, is ever addressed to anyone except the wise to whom it is sufficient. Even what is known as an ad hominem argument is only regarded by the person who uses it as a seduction designed to get the other in his authenticity to accept what the person says. This speech constitutes a pact, whether it is made explicit or not, between the two subjects, but it is situated in either case beyond the reasons furnished in the argument. In general, each person knows that others will remain, like himself, inaccessible to the constraints of reason. Failing on an a priori acceptance of a rule of debate that cannot function without an explicit or implicit agreement as to what is called its ground, which is almost always tantamount to a prior agreement regarding the stakes. What is called logic or law is never anything more than a body of rules that were laboriously worked out at a moment of history, duly dated and situated by a stamp of origin, whether agora or forum, church or even political party. Thus, I won't expect anything from these rules without the other's good faith, and as a last resort will only make use of them, if I see fit or am forced to, in order to beguile bad faith. The locus of speech. The other is, therefore, the locus in which is constituted the I who speaks, along with he who hears. What is said by the one being already the reply, the other deciding in hearing it whether the one has spoken or not. But in return, this locus extends as far into the subject as the laws of speech reign there, that is, well beyond the discourse that takes its watchwords from the ego, since Freud discovered its unconscious field and the laws that structure it. It is because of some mystery concerning the indestructibility of certain childhood desires that the laws of the unconscious determine analyzable symptoms. The subject's imaginary shaping of his desires, which are more or less fixated or regressed in relation to the object, is too inadequate and partial to provide the key. The necessary and sufficient reason for the repetitive insistence of these desires and the transference and their permanent remembrance in a signifier that repression has appropriated, that is, in which the repressed returns, is found if one accepts the idea that in these determinations the desire for recognition dominates the desire that is to be recognized, preserving it as such until it is recognized. Indeed, the laws of remembering and symbolic recognition are different in their essence and manifestation from the laws of imaginary reminiscence, that is, from the echo of feeling or instinctual imprinting, even if the elements organized by the former as signifiers are borrowed from the material to which the latter gives signification. To grasp the nature of symbolic memory, it suffices to have studied once, as I had people in my seminar, the simplest symbolic sequence, that of linear series of signs connoting the presence-absence alternative, each sign being chosen at random by whatever pure or impure means adopted. If this sequence is then elaborated in the simplest way, isolating three-term sequences to generate a new series, syntactical laws arise that impose on each of this new series certain exclusions of possibility until the compensations demanded by its antecedents have been satisfied. Freud's discovery went right to the heart of this determination by the symbolic law, for in the unconscious, which he insists was quite different from everything that had previously been designated by that name, he recognized the instance of the laws on which marriage and kinship are based, establishing the Oedipus concept as its central motivation already in the Traumdeutung. This is what now allows me to tell you why the motives of the unconscious are limited to sexual desire, a point on which Freud was quite clear from the outset, from which he never deviated. Indeed, it is essentially on sexual relations. By regulating them through according to the law of preferential marriage alliances and forbidden relations, that the first combinatory for exchanges of women between family lines relies, developing the fundamental commerce and concrete discourse on which social societies are based in an exchange of gratuitous goods and magic words. The concrete field of individual preservation, on the other hand, through its links with the division of not of labor but of desire and labor, already manifests right from the first transformation that introduced human signification into food and up to the most highly developed forms of the production of consumable goods, sufficiently shows that it is structured in the master-slave dialectic in which we can recognize the symbolic emergence of the imaginary struggle to the death that I defined above as the ego's essential structure. It is hardly surprising, then, that this field is exclusively reflected in this structure. In other words, this explains why the other great generic desire, hunger, is not represented, as Freud always maintained, in what the psych unconscious preserves in order to get it recognized. Thus, Freud's intention, which was quite legible to anyone who didn't confine himself to merely parroting Freud's text, became increasingly clear when he promoted the topography of the ego. His intention was to restore, in all its rigor, the separation right down to their unconscious interference between the field of the ego and that of the unconscious he discovered first, by showing that the former is in a blocking position in relation to the latter, the former resisting recognition of the latter through the effect of its own significations in speech. Here lies the contrast between the significations of guilt, whose discovery in the subject's action dominated the first phase in the history of psychoanalysis, and the significations of the subject's affective frustration, instinctual inadequacy, and imaginary dependence that dominate its current phase. It isn't going very far to say that the latter's significations, whose predominance is now consolidating through the forgetting of the former significations, promise us a preparatory course in general infantilization, for psychoanalysis is already allowing large-scale practices of social mystification to claim legitimacy by appealing to analytic principles. Symbolic debt. Will our action go so far, then, as to repress the very truth that it implies in its practice? Will it put this truth back to sleep? A truth that Freud, in The Passion of the Rat Man, forever offers up so that we may recognize it, should we increasingly turn our vigilance away from it, namely that the stone guest who came in symptoms to disturb the banquet of desires of his desires was fashioned out of acts of treachery and vain oaths, broken promises and empty words, whose constellation presided over a man's birth. For the sour grape of speech by which the child received the authentication of the nothingness of existence from a father too early, and the grapes of wrath that responded to the words of false hope with which his mother lured him in feeding him with the milk of her true despair, set his teeth on edge more than if he had been weaned from an imaginary jouissance or even deprived of real intentions. Will we escape unscathed from the symbolic game in which the real misdeed pays the price for imaginary temptation? Will we turn away our attention away from what becomes of the law when, by virtue of having been intolerable to the subject's loyalty, It is misrecognized by him already when it is still unknown to him. And from what becomes of the imperative when, having presented itself to him through imposture, it is challenged in his heart before being discerned. In other words, will we turn our attention away from the mainsprings that, in the broken link of the symbolic chain, raise from the imaginary obscene, ferocious figure in which the true signification of the superego must be seen? It should be understood here that my criticism of a kind of analysis that claims to be an analysis of resistance, and it is reduced ever more to the mobilization of the defenses, bears solely on the fact that it is disoriented in its practice as it is in its principles, and is designed to remind analysts of their legitimate ends. The maneuvers involving dyadic complicity that this form of analysis forces itself to implement to achieve happiness and success can have value in our eyes only if they reduce the resistance stemming from the effects of prestige in which the ego asserts itself to the speech that is owned at a certain moment of analysis, which is the analytic moment. I believe that it is in the owning of this speech, of which transference is the enigmatic actualization, that analysis must refind its center along with its gravity, and let no one imagine from what I said earlier that I conceptualize this speech as some mystical mode reminiscent of karma. For what is striking in the moving drama of neurosis is the absurd aspects of a disconcerted symbolization whose case of a mistaken identity seems more derisory the more one delves into it. Adequatio rei et intellectus. The homonymic enigma that can be brought out in the genitive rei, which without even changing accents can be the genitive of the word reus, meaning the party to the case in a lawsuit, specifically the accused, and metaphorically he who has incurred a debt, surprises us by providing in the end a formulation for this singular correspondence that I raised as a question for our intellect, and that finds its answer in the symbolic debt for which the subject is responsible as a subject of speech. The training of analysts to come. In taking up anew my analysis of the ways in which speech is able to recover the debt it engenders, I will thus return to the structures of language that are so manifestly recognizable in the earliest discovered mechanisms of the unconscious. We need but thumb through the pages of Freud's work for it to become abundantly clear that he regarded a history of languages and institutions and the resonances, whether attested to or not in the human memory or literature and of the significations involved in works of art, as necessary to an understanding of the text of our experience. Indeed, Freud himself found his inspiration, ways of thinking, and arsenal of techniques therein, but he also believed it wasn't superfluous to make them a condition for instituting the teaching of psychoanalysis. The fact that this condition has been neglected, even in the selection of analysts, cannot be unconnected with the results we see around us. It indicates to us that it is only by articulating Freud's requirements in terms of technique that we will be able to satisfy them. It is with an initiation into the methods of the linguist, the historian, and, I would add, the mathematician, that we should now be concerned if a new generation of practitioners and researchers is to recover the meaning and force of the Freudian experience. This generation will also find in these methods a way to avoid social psychological objectification, in which the psychoanalyst seeks, in his uncertainty, the substance of what he does, whereas it can provide him with no more than an inadequate abstraction in which his practice gets bogged down and dissolves. Such reform will require an institutional undertaking, for it can only be sustained by means of constant communication with disciplines that would define themselves as sciences of intercepted subjectivity, or by the term conjectural sciences, a term by which I indicate the kind of research that is now changing the implications of the human sciences. But such a direction can only be maintained by a true teaching, that is, teaching that constantly subjects itself to what is known as renewal. For the pact instituting analytic experience must take into account the fact that this experience instates the very effects that capture it, diverting it from the subject. Thus, in exposing magical thinking, people don't see that it is magical thinking and, in fact, an alibi for thoughts about wielding power that are ever ready to bring about their own rejection in an action that is sustained only by its connection with truth. Freud is referring to this connection with truth when he declares that it is impossible to meet three challenges: to educate, govern, and to psychoanalyze. Why are they impossible? If not for the fact that the subject can only be missed in these undertakings, slipping away in the margin Freud reserves for truth. For in these undertakings, truth proves to be complex in its essence, humble in its offices, and foreign to reality, refractory to the choice of sex, akin to death, and, on the whole, rather inhumane. Diana, perhaps. Acteon, too. Guilty to hunt the goddess, prey in what is caught. O huntsman, the shadow that you become, let the pack go without hastening your step. Diana will recognize the hounds for what they are worth.